This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Tampa, Florida. We're here with Bobby Newman. His family has owned Newman Cigar Company since, what,
1895.
Wow. You're the last man standing.
My father used to say that, yes. The last man at the poker table gets all the chips.
So back in the day, I mean, I grew up with Have a Tampa, you know,
right,
and the Fuente Brothers. Those logos and images were permeated in my culture and world growing up.
Right.
I just did not realize to what extent that Tampa, Florida was world headquarters for making cigars. How many cigar companies were here back in the day?
At one point, there were 10 large factories making 500 million, 500 million cigars using Cuban wrapper, Cuban binder, and Cuban filler.
And again, that's the other fascinating aside about Tampa, is the Cuban connection.
Right.
And today, the cuisine and culture very much permeates the town, doesn't it?
Very, very powerful, yes. Yeah. Yes.
So let's go back in time with your family. How did it happen?
Unless you're Native American, we all, as Americans, came from overseas. And Grandpa J.C. was born, and I remember him well. He died when I was 7 years old in 1958. Grandpa J.C. was born 10 years after the American Civil War. Here we are, and I remember him, and my brother and I remember him very well. Grandpa J.C. came to the United States in 1888. He lived in the Austria-Hungarian Empire. And the reason our great-grandmother, my brother's Eric, the reason our great-grandparents came to the United States was because in the mid-1880s, the emperor, or whatever the prime minister, the head of the country was called, he was taking all the boys 13 and up into the army. And, of course, then the slaughter rate was 80%. Mm-hmm. So great-grandmother said, hey, we're going to America. And that was part of the great wave of immigration from the 1800s. Because Grandpa J.C. came to the United States. Mm-hmm. It's funny, after World War I, they changed the borders. So his boyhood home is now in eastern Slovakia.
Oh, wow.
Which is not near the Ukrainian border.
Mm-hmm.
But so he came to the United States in 1888 as a 13-year-old. Tom, you and probably most of the listeners' family, they came through Ellis Island. Mm-hmm. Grandpa J.C. came through Baltimore. We don't know why. Mm-hmm. But when he landed, his name was, as far as we can tell, was Julius Neumann. Everyone who lived in the Austria-Hungarian Empire at the time, they all spoke Hungarian and German. So Grandpa J.C. came to Baltimore, didn't have a middle name, and through a translator, they told him they couldn't come into the country unless he had a middle name. And they said, look, Grandpa J.C. was very short for his age. At fully grown, he was like 5'5". Or 5'4". Mm-hmm. And he married a woman 5'6". So the wedding pictures are hysterical because he's shorter. It's like Mutt and Jeff. And so they gave him a name, Caesar. The immigration officer said, your middle name could be Caesar. You'll be Julius Caesar. Your new last name is Newman, N-E-W-M-A-N. And it's interesting because they spelled Caesar wrong. It should be A-R, and his spelling was E-R. And we never thought anything about it until we came out with a cigar to honor his 135th birthday. In 2010, we came out with the Diamond Crown Julius Caesar line that we're here. I know we're not smoking cigars, but and that's the band is him, what he looked like in May of 1895 when he started our business.
How cool.
And they ended up in Cleveland, Ohio. Don't know why, but Cleveland at the time had the largest enclave of Hungarians. What we do know is that the highest paying jobs were in the North. In the South, even those after the Civil War, there's very little manufacturing after the Civil War. It was an agrarian society. It was tobacco and cotton. The factory workers and the factories primarily were in the North. So Grandpa J.C. settled in Cleveland. Obviously, there are no labor laws then. At the time, Grandpa J.C., his four brothers all became tailors. He didn't want to become a tailor. He wanted to become a cigar maker. And you have to remember, Probably today, 7% of the American male population smokes cigars. Back then, it was 80%.
Wow.
And
more so than cigarettes, right? Cigarettes didn't become popular till later.
Till after World War I. I can tell you this in 30 seconds. It's interesting. Cigars were huge until America got into World War I, because the Red Cross sent to the doughboys, that's what they called them, they sent them a care package constantly, and they put cigarettes in there.
Uh-huh.
So you have, I think, 3 million American servicemen served in World War I. 80% of them were cigar smokers. Here's the Red Cross sending them cigarettes, and cigars are, because of the way the tobacco is cured, it's not designed, you don't inhale it, it's too heavy, very uncomfortable. Cigarettes, because of the way the tobacco is cured, has a lot of sugar in it, so you can inhale it in your lungs. So these 3 million American soldiers that were cigar smokers, or 80% of them, they came back as cigarette smokers, and that was the first tremendous decline of the cigar industry. But just wanted to tell you that about cigarettes.
No, because I'm always curious about that.
Right.
You know? How did that happen? Why did cigarettes all of a sudden become a thing? And now it's really interesting. If you smoked a cigarette, people would look at you like you're a drug addict. And you go, well, I'm a heroin addict. You know, that's okay, but just don't smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
And then the very same people who are just so against cigarette smoking, there's like an immunity in the cigar world. It's still cool to this day. Yeah. It must be predicated partly on, like you said, it's not a inhaling experience.
Well, it is. And listen, we're sitting in my office with two beautiful dogs from Southeastern Guide Dogs. And whether you're Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter to me. And I don't think it matters to most Americans. We're all Americans. That's the most important thing. But the reason I said this is because when President Obama came into office, the first bill that he passed was the Family Tobacco Prevention Act. And it was regulated for the first time cigarettes, smokeless tobacco like Skoal and Copenhagen, and roll your own. Because the cigarette companies, those three products are all to be designed to be ingested or inhaled. Mm-hmm. That bill was not meant for cigars, but which often happens in Washington, we became an unintended consequence. So the FDA said, you know what, we got this mandate from Congress to regulate cigarette, smokeless tobacco, and roll your own, which is cigarette tobacco that you roll, like you've seen in the movies with John Wayne, you roll it with a white piece of paper. Let's just regulate everything. So we've been fighting with the FDA, and there has to be an FDA. Obviously, otherwise we'd be eating hamburgers with E. coli all the time. We understand that. But the FDA did a study, and of course they didn't tell anybody. They had two conclusions, and they did it with the Center for Disease Control. And because of COVID, unless you've been living under a rock, everyone knows who the CDC is out of Atlanta. It came out in 2017 in the New England Journal of Medicine. We have it. I'll be glad to send it to you or anybody listener. And it concluded that youth meaning boys and girls under 18 years old, do not smoke premium cigars, which we knew that. They're not going to smoke a $5 or $10 cigar. And also it said that the CDC came out and said that the average American cigar smoker smokes 1.7 cigars per month, and that will not affect mortality. That means it will not shorten your life, it will not increase your life. So we took that, and we met with Dr. Scott Gottlieb when he was the FDA commissioner, and we sat down with him at the FDA and explained this, and they all know it, but you always have zealots. You've got people that don't want you to drink liquor or smoke cigars, whatever. My two sons, 23 and 26, they don't smoke cigarettes. I don't think they have, out of 100 friends, they may have two people that smoke cigarettes, but they all love cigars when they're playing poker or whatever. So cigars have been very long-term and very popular.
1A, tell me about the process of ideally savoring and enjoying a cigar.
That's it. Tom, I've been doing these things for 50 years. No one's ever asked me that question. Are you listening, Laura? One of the great things about cigars is that in the Tampa Bay area, there's probably 50 locations, smoke shops. Some of them have bars. You can go and smoke a cigar. And when I was Laura's age, the young lady, probably 30, you would never find a woman, very rare, sitting with another man, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, whatever, a husband, wife, smoking cigars, and now you do. The great thing about cigars is because you sit down with a cigar – And you sit down and there's another person in the room. They can be African-American, they can be blue, they can be black, they can be Muslim, they can be Hindu, female, male, it doesn't matter. You have an instant bond. And the great thing about premium cigars is that, unlike a cigarette, in wintertime you'll see people huddle, it could be 30 degrees below zero, and you see people huddled outside trying to get that nicotine. Cigars is not about nicotine, it's about relaxation. You light the cigar, it's the whole thing. You cut the cigar, you light it, and you smell it, and you suck on it, and you, when you light it, you bring the smoke into your mouth and you blow it out. You do not inhale it. Mm-hmm. And the industry got lucky because of the way the tobacco is aged. And I've never said this, and it's all, I mean, it's, I haven't said this publicly, but it's the truth. The reason people don't inhale cigars is because of the way the tobacco is cured. If you go in North Carolina or Virginia, they still grow cigarette tobacco up there. But the way the tobacco is cured, so when it's ready pulled out of the fields, it's green in color. They take the tobacco and they put it in barns and they seal the barns up for 3 days and they run the temperature up to about 140 to 160 degrees and you seal the barn. After 3 days, you open the barn up, you let it air out, and the tobacco is still the beautiful green color. What's happened to it is that, I hate to use the word chemically, but what's happened is that the sugar, the way it's cured, the sugars are still into the tobacco, which means once you age that tobacco, you can, it's made into a cigarette, you can inhale it, and it's not uncomfortable for your lungs. Cigar tobacco, it's in the field for about 6 weeks, and it's hung up in barns, and it's usually hung up anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the level of humidity, and it slowly turns from a green to a beautiful light brown color. It smells like you walk in these barns in Dominican Republic or Honduras or even Connecticut, where they grow Connecticut shade and Connecticut broadleaf tobacco. But what happens, it smells like a sweet hay. It's got a wonderful aroma. When you take it out of the barns, it's acetic. If you roll it into a cigar and you try to inhale it, it's very, very unpleasant, very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So because of that, and the industry got lucky, that's the way God made it, because the only way you can enjoy a cigar, just bring it in your mouth and blow the smoke out, mm-hmm. and you get the taste from there.
Interesting. And it's kind of like single malt whiskey is very much an olfactory experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
90% of it is in the bouquet.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't realize that.
Right.
It's kind of like, if you want to not like cigars, inhale.
I say the only people that inhale cigars are former cigarette smokers.
Yeah.
They think, well, I'll switch to cigars.
And they don't realize.
And that's, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, it is.
All right, only because we're out of time and I got to catch the bus.
Yes, sir.
Highlights of your family history. And one thing that's intrigued me is Arturo Puente.
Right.
And that relationship. I always thought forever they were independent.
Well, they are independent, but, and I'm going to give you and Laura the book called Cigar Family. There's a whole chapter in there, how we got together with him. 1986, which was 31 years ago, am I right?
A long time ago.
Anyway, my father and my brother and I had a leverage to buy out. I went to my dad in 1985. We had 14 other family members in the business. It's like the Hatfields and the McCoys. I said, Dad, we either got to buy, we have to buy them out or they have to buy us out. My father and brother... my brother's still my best friend, and if I was down to my last dollar, I'd give him 51 cents, a type of relationship. My dad, we worked with him for years, and we had a leverage buyout February 14th, which was Valentine's Day, 1986. We bought all 14 of our relatives out, and highly leveraged. We didn't have a pot to pee in financially, but we had the company. We felt like we could make this thing a go. And 3 or 4 weeks after our leverage buyout, this gentleman named, who had a small manufacturing operation 6 blocks from here, named Carlos Fuente Sr., came to see us, and he wanted to shut his operation. He was making 3 million cigars a year, 6 blocks from here, and he wanted to shut his operation down and have us make, he asked us if we'd make his cigars, because he had just, this was 1986, he just started all over again in 1980 in the Dominican Republic. He had been burned out by the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and during the 70s, and he went over to Honduras after he lost his factory, lost everything, went to Honduras, had an electrical fire, lost everything again. I mean, Hollywood cannot produce this type of story. Came back to the United States for a few months, and he went to Santiago, Dominican Republic. It started all over again for like the third time. So fast forward, here we are. We had our leveraged buyout, and Carlos Fuente Sr. says, I want to close my factory. And he asked us if we would make his cigars. We said, yes, we would, but we wanted to get back in the hand cigar-making business. We only made cigars on these antique 1931, 90-year-old machines. So Carlos Fuente Sr. and his son Carlito started making a brand we had called La Unica. All the cigars traditionally are in beautiful boxes. They're in cedar, mahogany, leather. And all the bundle cigars that were put in bundles were all the cigars that had a hole, either they would be, have a hole in the wrapper, they were patched, or their wrappers didn't look good or whatever. All the junk went into bundles. My father had an idea. We're going to come out. We own the label La Unica, means the one or the only. We're going to come out. We're going to call it La Unica Dominican Primeros, which means Dominican first. It'll be the first bundle in the history of the cigar world that has cigars that are really first. And it will market it saying, look, instead of paying for the boxes and all the trimmings, which is like maybe $3 or $4 back then, you can get a great value cigar. Cigar took off. And that's how, and this is 1986. At the same time, we were beyond broke. We weren't broke. We owed millions of dollars. And that's a whole nother story. But we had a great sales force, but we didn't have a... People loved our cigars. It was Cuesta Rey and Rigoletto, but they want them handmade. We didn't have a hand cigar-making operation. So we told the Fuentes, look, we have this great sales force. How about we start selling your cigars? And on a brokerage basis, they paid us a 5% commission. And in 1986, we had 22 states. We grew their business so much that we... 4 years later, we started a company called Fanco, Fuente & Newman Cigar Company. We became their importer for all the brick and mortar. And that was 21 years ago.
And it continues today,
It continues
right?
to this day.
That's so cool.
You build it, and they will come. Mm-hmm. That's from Field of Dreams, to quote my brother, Carlito Fuente. And that was 1990. And then there's the whole story. See, so 1990, then about in 2000, 2001, my brother was in, I know we're crushed for time, but my brother was with Carlito, and they were driving through one of their farms in Dominican, in the poorest part of the region, and they saw children at 11 o'clock in the morning, 6, 7 years old, they're playing in the stream, but their bellies were distended, the water was bad. They had one school for the whole region. It looked like Little House of the Prairie. So we ended up building our own school.
And it's still there.
It's called Cigar Family, yeah.
That's really
and,
cool.
And there's 5,000 people in the valley. Mm-hmm. Each child gets shoes, a uniform, from kindergarten to 12th grade. They get two hot meals a day. We're not that smart or sexy. Mm-hmm. There's no electricity, so we put our own solar panels up, which was hard in 2003. Opened the school 2004.
Do you have a link on the Newman Cigar website to that project?
We do, and it's Cigar Family Charitable Foundation, and the website is CF, like Charlie Frank dash Charlie Frank, CF-CF.org, mm-hmm. and you can get a whole tour down there. And there,
okay.
Yes, sir.
I have to cut you off.
Okay. two big talkers.
I am. Kind of neutralize this whole thing because I have to catch the bus.
I understand.
Which means that I'm coming back.
Right.
We're going to do part two of Bobby Newman in the cigar world. I love it. Bobby Newman, it's been an absolute honor and a pleasure to visit with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for this opportunity to help us tell our story. And
yeah.
We want to help other people.
Yep. And website for Newman Cigar Company?
Is jcnewman.com. J as in Jeff, C as in Charlie, then Newman. Paul Newman is our fifth cousin, so if you can't remember that, think of Paul Newman, the actor.
There you go. We've been speaking with Bobby Newman, Executive Vice President of the J.C. Newman Cigar Company in Tampa, Florida. We'll see you here.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.